When he was nearly 13, my brother Jim got his arm badly broken at the elbow. When it healed, and Jim's fears of never being able to play football were assuaged, he was seldom self-conscious about his injury. His left arm was somewhat shorter than his right. When he stood or walked, the back of his hand was at right angles to his body, his thumb parallel to his thigh. He couldn't have cared less, so long as he could pass and punt. When enough years had gone by to enable us to look back on them, we sometimes discuss the events leading to his accident. I maintain that the Yule started it all, but Jim, who was 4 years my senior, said it started long before that. He said it began the summer Dill came to us, when Dill first gave us the idea of making Boo Radley come out. I said if he wanted to take a broad view of the thing, it really began with Andrew Jackson. If General Jackson hadn't run the creeks up the creek, Simon Finch would never have paddled up the Alabama. And where would we be if he hadn't? We were far too old to settle an argument with a fist fight, so we consulted Atticus. Our father said we were both right.
Harper Lee's wondrous evocation of life in a small town in the Deep South in the 1930s. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. It's October, and here in Sonoma County, that means The Big Read, sponsored by KRCB in partnership with the Sonoma County Library, Sonoma County Library Foundation, the Arts Council of Sonoma County, the Sonoma County Book Festival, Sonoma State University, Santa Rosa Junior College, and Copperfield's Books. That's quite a list, and you may be wondering what exactly is The Big Read. The Big Read is a nationwide project sponsored by the National Endowment for the Arts under the leadership of Dana Gioia, whom we're proud to claim as one of us. Sonoma County is one of 208 communities that have chosen to participate in The Big Read. Local sponsors select a book from a list provided by the NEA and organize activities related to that book. Last year, you may remember, the book was Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury. This year, people all over Sonoma County, young and old, are reading To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, and I invite you to join. Check out the website, bigreadsonoma.com, for a complete listing of activities, reading, discussions, dramatizations of scenes from the book. For those of you who are not online, I can only imagine how annoying it is to be instructed to go to the website. So I invite you to call Robin Metelitz, KRCB Outreach Coordinator, at 707-584-2005. Or you can go to the local library for information, or call the library. I want to give my special thanks to Nancy Dobbs, the CEO and President of KRCB, and Robin Pressman, Program Director for KRCB Radio, for making it possible for Sonoma County to sponsor The Big Read. My guest here in the studio is Mira Katz, Associate Professor of English at Sonoma State University. She teaches courses geared specifically to those who hope to become English teachers at the secondary and community college levels. These courses include explorations in language, children's literature, youth and literature, teaching and responding to literature, and more. Mira, I'd love to hear more about your work.
Thank you. I have been teaching in English education for, since the early 1990s, and this is my seventh year at Sonoma State. And as you mentioned, I work primarily with pre-service middle and high school teachers. We do get some folks coming through who would like to work with community college students. And my background is in language and literacy education. So I always, although I'm in an English department, my background's in education, so I sort of have a foot in both worlds.
I wish you'd been around when I was preparing to be an English teacher back in the days when dinosaurs roamed the earth. We didn't have any courses like that, I can assure you. And I'm so grateful that those courses are being offered now, and a little envious of those who are preparing today to be teachers.
Well, you're welcome to join us anytime.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'd love to.
Please.
And I notice you have an emphasis on cross-cultural and intercultural communication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, California has always been a diverse state and remains one, and I think it's critical for our future teachers, our current students, to think about what it means to teach in multilingual, multicultural settings. And so that is definitely an emphasis in our program.
And I saw something about language, gender, and power. That certainly got my attention.
Yeah. Well, this may be a little far afield, but my graduate work was focused on immigrant women in workplace literacy programs. So I was looking at women in a variety of settings, in a chain of hotels, a small boutique chain of hotels in San Francisco, who were most of them Spanish speakers who were taking English in the workplace. And I was down in Silicon Valley in an electronics manufacturing plant where men and women were on the line working in an electronics factory and were also offered English classes. And then in a community-based center in San Francisco where people were training to be secretaries. So, of course, it was mostly women there as well.
Well, you're a natural for the work that you're doing, and it's such important work. Your program seems to me to be a perfect forum for the book we're talking about today, To Kill a Mockingbird, in terms of, well, I was thinking language, gender, and power. It had been many years since I read To Kill a Mockingbird, and I was amazed how much of the story I remembered.
Hmm.
I think the story, once you've read it, it stays with you. It takes root. Rereading a good novel is such a great experience, and I can appreciate more how the writer builds the story and seems to know his or her place. And it seems to be, in this case, Macomb, Georgia, a small town in which everyone seems to know his or her place, and things don't change much. And then Harper Lee introduces us to her family cluster of characters. Jean Louise Finch, better known as Scout, and her older brother, Jeremy Atticus Finch, known as Jim, their father, Atticus Finch, an attorney, and Calpurnia, the black woman who carries the responsibility for the care of the children and the household because the mother is deceased. On the very first page, before the writer has described the chief characters or introduced us to Atticus and Calpurnia, she introduces an outsider, in this case, a boy, Charles Baker Harris, better known as Dill. And she writes, "It all began the summer Dill came to us, when Dill first gave us the idea of making Boo Radley come out." I was amazed. It's right there on the first page.
Yeah.
I had the idea of this small community and of the necessity of bringing in an outsider to open up the community, open up the story. Did you feel that way about it?
I felt that Dill, it's one of the questions I asked my students, actually, was what they thought Dill's role was. And I really felt that he created this triangle between Jem and Scout and himself. But I think you're right that he also brought the perspective of someone from Meridian, where he was supposedly from, and helped them, I think, in some ways to see outside themselves, which, of course, was something that Atticus was always trying to get them to do. One of my favorite lines is his repeated request for them to climb into someone else's skin and walk around in it for a while.
That's one of my favorite lines in it, too. Such an amazing concept.
Yeah.
But I see, I think I understand what you're saying, that left to themselves, Scout and Jim might not have pursued Boo Radley, which turns out to be the thrust of the story. But Dill provokes them.
There's also, I don't know if it's meant to be childhood sort of belief in ghosts or magic, but there's something obviously sort of ghost-like about Boo Radley himself and about the whole house. You know, the house is given all these personal characters. It's Harper Lee talks about it as being droopy and sad and as, you know, sort of exuding misery. But the ghostliness, I think, is connected with a certain kind of magic. And early on in the book, Scout refers to Dill as a pocket Merlin, which I thought was quite wonderful. And I think that there is a certain magic for them about things like the gifts in the tree and the way that Jem's pants are magically sort of folded and sewn up and put over the fence as if they were expecting him, he says, when he comes back really puzzled by the fact that things were just waiting for him.
We're assuming that our listeners are fairly well acquainted with the story because so far I've only talked to one person who's never read the story.
Uh-huh.
And I've been asking a lot of people what their memories of the story since I knew we were going to do it.
Yeah.
And so I urge those of you who don't know the story to rush right out and get a copy of it so you can have the pleasure of reading it for yourself. There are some elements of autobiography in the book. I mean, Harper Lee's life has some similarities with Scout. We'll talk about that in a bit. And some feel that Dill is based on Truman Capote, who was a neighbor to Harper Lee.
Mm-hmm. That was my understanding. And from the Big Read materials, I think that I was led to understand that, in fact, Dill's character was really based on their friendship and he really did, in fact, live right next door to Harper Lee when she was growing up.
Yes, and they knew each other since kindergarten.
Right.
And then he moved to New York and came for the summer. So you can see where the thread of that story
right.
comes from.
And then their relationship as adults continued as they both became writers. And,
yes. Then that relationship kind of fell apart. She went with him to Kansas when he was writing In Cold Blood. She was writing To Kill a Mockingbird at the same time, and he went over her manuscript with her, and then later some people said that he actually wrote it. I mean, things really didn't go well between them.
Yeah, my sense was that he was jealous of her sort of overnight popularity. Resulting from this book, I mean, clearly he worked hard as an author for years and years and was really, I think someone called him the enfant terrible of the writing world. And, you know, here she was only ever to write this one book and to have it be such a smashing success.
Yes.
Must have been a little frustrating for people
and then
around
their lifestyles
her.
Lifestyles became so different that he his career path was so different from hers, and so I think their friendship didn't last throughout their lives. And then, of course, he died so young, and she's still alive. Is that right?
I believe
so.
So.
I couldn't
yeah.
find anything that indicated that she wasn't.
Yeah, to my knowledge, she is. In fact, I think she just may have received some kind of award recently.
Oh. Well, let's talk a bit more about Harper Lee. Her father a lawyer, her mother a homemaker. Her father defended two black men accused of murder who were hanged. I mean, there's certain similarities here. Her sister Alice became an attorney, and Harper tried law school and just couldn't do it. I mean, I guess it didn't make sense to her. And then while she was in New York, she worked for 8 years on To Kill a Mockingbird. And, you know, at one point, Her editor, Tay Hohoff, described it as a string of stories. And when I was rereading it, I saw it that way for the first time. The different episodes, it could have been one of those books of linked short stories that people are writing now. Mm-hmm. I think it's a stronger book the way it is. But I see it now as a series of stories.
Hmm. I was very aware of each chapter tending to center around a particular person. This time through, it seemed to me that they were each oriented to a particular character. If it was more string-like at one point, I'm glad that she pushed through the additional editorial work, because I just think it's such a lovely work.
Oh, it's beautiful.
As it is.
It's just exceptional. And then that wonderful story how she lost patience with the whole thing and threw it out the window.
Yeah.
You just want to go, oh, no, how close we came to not having it.
And fortunately, her editor told her to go out and pick it up from the snow.
And she did.
And she did.
Do they have editors like that now?
Boy, I wish.
I wish. It's a beautiful title, isn't it?
Yes.
I'd forgotten the meaning of it.
Yeah.
I was trying to think, why did they call it that?
Yeah.
And then at the very end, it's like hitting a bell or a gong again when the Mockingbird theme comes in at the very end, the same expression. It would be like killing a mockingbird.
Right. And I was, I recently rewatched the film, too, with Gregory Peck, which is absolutely wonderful.
I did the same thing, yes.
And I thought that in the film it was even perhaps clearer, that sort of tying the knot at the end in terms of the narrative and the meaning of the title, when Scout says, Boo Radley's standing in the shadows and Jem's in bed with his broken arm, and she says to Atticus, well, it would be a sin, wouldn't it, like to kill a mockingbird? I love that moment, you know. And it's again, I think, a moment that the kind of moment that we see throughout, which is a respect for children's wisdom. You know, he's ready to send Jem off to court. He thinks that Jem is going to be tried for murder. And his their friend says no. You know, Hectate says,
Hectate. The names are so great.
Yeah.
Says no.
No, he fell on his knife.
I wish that the movie could have been 2 hours longer.
Because I agree.
Scenes I wanted to see. I wanted to see Scout in the first grade with Miss Caroline. And I did want to see the scene in the black church.
Oh, so did I. That was one of my very favorite scenes.
Yes.
And after that scene, the conversation that Jem and Scout have with Calpurnia is by far one of my favorite conversations in the book. I just think it's so wonderful. Another thing that was really missing for me was Aunt Alexandra. I mean, I think the whole dynamic she creates in that household.
She wasn't in the movie.
And Uncle Jack. Neither is Uncle Jack. So,
you were going to read something.
I'm trying to find here. Yeah, at one point she refers to Aunt Alexandra as like Mount Everest, cold and there. So they've just gone to church with Calpurnia, which in itself is quite an experience, as you say. And they have a conversation, and they're trying to figure out. They have observed that Calpurnia is talking differently with the people at church than she does at their house. And they say, you know, why do you do that? And of course their argument is, you know, you know how to talk right. How come you're not talking right? And they have this back and forth, and she says, well, in the first place, I'm black. That doesn't mean you have to talk that way when you know better, said Jem. Calpurnia tilted her hat and scratched her head, then pressed her hat down carefully over her ears. It's right hard to say, she said. Suppose you and Scout talk colored folks talk at home. It'd be out of place, wouldn't it? Now what if I talked white folks talk at church and with my neighbors? They'd think I was putting on airs to beat Moses. But Cal, you know better, I said. It's not necessary to tell all you know. It's not ladylike. In the second place, folks don't like to have somebody around knowing more than they do. It aggravates them. You're not going to change any of them by talking right. They've got to want to learn themselves. And when they don't want to learn, there's nothing you can do but keep your mouth shut or talk their language.
I'd be so interested to know how your students respond to the story and to particular incidents in the story.
I think one of the things that struck my students, well, there are a couple of things. One was that many of my students, of course, read it in high school because it's these days part of the sophomore year curriculum for many kids, some freshman year even. So it was a second read for many of my students, which I was really pleased about. But one of the things that interested me was they commented that the first time they read the book, that it was so layered with history of social movements and historical events that they sort of lost the book. They lost sight of the story. And I was intrigued and surprised because as a teacher, of course, I want to build in those connections. It was written at this, you know, pivotal moment in our country's history. And, you know, we were on the verge of sort of an explosion of sorts. And it was striking to me, though, that what they felt they'd missed was the literary experience itself. Just reading the book and admiring the book for the story and the language and the evocation of characters. And I think it made me think more about being careful about how we do that as teachers. Certainly, you know, it's good teaching practice to integrate social and historical context in which the author was writing and really try to create a feeling and a picture for our students so that the book becomes more accessible. But my sense was that for some of them, that had been done sort of to the detriment of the artistic dimensions of the work itself. And I was surprised by that.
Could they relate to a time before the Voting Rights Act and to the way the conditions were in the country at that time back in the 30s?
I think it's difficult. I think the Depression is hard to imagine because I think most of my students have not experienced poverty, sort of widespread poverty. I mean, what a real crash would mean as one looms over our heads at the moment. Yeah, it does. You know, they get a glimpse, I think, of gendered roles. But I'm not sure that they really can feel what it would have felt like to be a woman or a man in that context, in the community of Macomb, and to be black or white and a woman or a man in that context.
Aunt Alexandra must seem a strange character for them then.
Yeah, I think so. She... just so proper,
yes.
You know, wanting teas and wanting to get Scout out of her britches. And,
yes. And so indignant that
yeah.
Scout has been allowed to
right.
To be a tomboy.
Yeah.
I don't know if we have many Aunt Alexandras around these days. I think we have more Scouts than we used to.
Yeah, I think so, too.
They're easing up that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, when you're teaching To Kill a Mockingbird, how do you handle the language? I mean, the words used for Negro are words that are so offensive to us now.
Yeah.
I just can't bring myself to utter the word that was used colloquially in those days because it's so derogatory.
Mm-hmm.
When you're teaching it, is that a problem?
It hasn't been so far, but I think it makes us all uncomfortable.
Oh, yes.
And that's a good thing
yes.
in some ways. So
that's right.
I think the fact that the language is still so charged is a message in itself to us about where we are today with relations between communities and ethnicities and race relations. And
we're embarrassed at the way things used to be, but perhaps we're also embarrassed that we haven't come as far as perhaps we think we have.
Yeah.
That there are still some very basic problems there to be dealt with.
Yeah, and I think that's at the root of the discomfort for us when we read these.
The trial of Tom Robinson really takes over the second half of the book. Part two of the book is essentially the story of that trial. And when we remember the book, that's probably what we remember, and especially when we remember the movie, because Gregory Peck was so powerful. And the way she sets up the contrast between the two families, the Ewell family, Mayella and her father, and the total lack of any responsibility, any feeling for each other, any of the characteristics that we look for in people seem to be lacking in the Ewells. And then there's the Robinson family, Tom, who's been accused of raping Mayella, and the nobility of his character. It's made so clear. I think it comes out maybe more clearly in the book than in the movie, because of course the book can dwell on it and do the interior monologue and the exposition and take time building the scene, whereas in the movie it has to move more quickly. But what an interesting, of course she didn't invent that. Her own father had been in the same position defending two Negro men who were accused of murder and were hanged. So she certainly knew what the feelings that she was describing, and she so carefully built those characters and built toward that scene.
And certainly the scene in the courtroom in the movie with Gregory Peck is so powerful, particularly his speech to the jury, where he confronts them pretty directly with their feelings about what it means for a black man to feel sorry for a white woman during that time and how insulted they are. And he really takes issue with that, and I think his explicitness is nevertheless obviously ignored. He basically says the unsayable.
That's right. And when you hear it, well, when you read it or when you hear it, you just gasp and you think, oh no, I shouldn't have said that.
Right. You know as soon as you hear it that trouble is coming.
That's right. Do you think that the prosecuting attorney set him up for it?
I don't know if it was purposeful.
It seemed like an accident.
Yeah, my sense is that Tom Robinson is such a decent human being, and it was natural for him to feel sorry for someone who seemed not to have much available to her, not many resources, not much help. And he did what he could because she was another human being, not because of her color or anything else. And I think he would have done it for anyone who asked.
And quite often in those extreme racial situations, the way that the white people could continue to keep the black people in subjectivity is by saying that they're not human.
Right.
And Tom Robinson was behaving as a human being, and they couldn't forgive him.
Yeah.
He sealed his own fate by expressing humanity.
Mm-hmm.
That was a powerful moment.
Yeah, extremely disturbing.
Yes.
One of the scenes, however, I think that shows, tiny cracks in Macomb County's ethos is the scene where Scout and Jem and Dill appear. Atticus decides to stand watch when Tom Robinson is being kept in jail, and the mob led by the Cunninghams and the Yules, I suppose, comes down to get at Tom Robinson, basically. And Atticus is there sitting, keeping guard, and his kids show up, and of course he's mortified because he's scared for their safety. And Scout, in her childhood innocence and wisdom, starts talking to Mr. Cunningham in that wonderful way and says, "Hey, Mr. Cunningham, I know your son,
right.
And he's a good boy, and, you know," she asks about his entailment, and and then she says, "Say hey to him," and he can no longer keep up this. I mean, she sort of just breaks through this hardness and this sort of macho facade, and you feel them all sort of melt, you know, or wilt. And they back off and go home. They've sort of lost the umph to carry out whatever it was they came to do. It's a lovely moment.
And your mind goes back to the scene where Scout has invited Walter Cunningham to come home to supper. And they're so surprised when he pours syrup all over his plate. And Atticus shushes them and
right.
says, "He is your guest."
Right.
Yeah.
And Calpurnia scolds Scout and takes her into the kitchen because
yeah, that's right. Yeah,
she says, "Yeah, yeah." And I love the way that that she describes Calpurnia. There are a lot of wonderful descriptions of just language itself. Calpurnia, she's talking about her. She says she was furious, and when she was furious, Calpurnia's grammar became erratic. When in tranquility, her grammar was as good as anybody's in Macomb. Atticus said Calpurnia had more education than most colored folks. She says, "When she squinted down at me, the tiny lines around her eyes deepened. 'There's some folks who don't eat like us,' she whispered fiercely. 'But you ain't called on to contradict 'em at the table when they don't. That boy's your company, and if he wants to eat up the tablecloth, you let him. You hear?'"
We're going to take a short break. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester. My guest is Mira Katz. We're talking about Harper Lee's beautiful book, To Kill a Mockingbird, which is the book for the big read this week.
Don't weep.
No, we don't weep.
Don't mourn.
Your host, and my guest is Mira Katz of Sonoma State University, and we're talking about the book To Kill a Mockingbird. Mira, you were talking about your students having some interpretation of some of the things that happen in the book and some of the words. I found this wonderful website called The Student Survival Guide, and I'm sure your students consult it often. I hope it didn't seem to me like a cheat sheet. It seemed to me like an attempt to ground them in what life was like in this country that long ago. Mm. Is it a site that your students use?
I don't know.
Oh, it's new to you.
Yeah, it's new to me.
There were three divisions. There were idioms, allusions, and vocabulary.
Oh, that sounds great. Sounds wonderful.
Fascinating. You'll have to check it out.
Yeah.
I was laughing at some of the things that, for example, in idioms, I noticed how they were related to farming. Walked on eggs, meant to walk on eggs is to walk very carefully. As sure as eggs, something that as sure as eggs is a sure thing. It's bound to happen, just as chickens lay eggs. And get Miss Maudie's goat. Well, you know, those weren't too hard to figure out.
Uh-huh.
But those were the idioms. I was amazed that they defined Pensacola as a city in Florida. It's like, you know, some of these things seem obvious to me, but I shouldn't make assumptions.
Well, It's well known that American students' geography is not the best.
Right.
And so that may be regional knowledge that doesn't quite reach this far west. But
yes.
And there's other regional vocabulary.
Yes.
For example, I had to look up scuppernong, a word I did not know, and I now know that it's a plum-like fruit.
Mm-hmm.
But the language is sophisticated, and it's also, you know, I think integral to how Scout and Atticus and Jem communicate with one another. Scout characterizes people's language in various ways, as she did Calpurnia's. And she talks about, I'll have to look for it, but there's a spot in here where she talks about Atticus's language. She's describing his diction, but it happens to be in the context of him asking her if she knows what a compromise is. And so he says, "Do you know what a compromise is?" And Scout says, "Bending the law?" "No, an agreement reached by mutual concessions. It works this way," he said. "If you'll concede the necessity of going to school, we'll go on reading every night just as we always have. Is it a bargain?" "Yes, sir." "We'll consider it sealed without the usual formality," Atticus said when he saw me preparing to spit. As I opened the front screen door, Atticus said, "By the way, Scout, you'd better not say anything at school about our agreement." "Why not?" "I'm afraid our activities would be received with considerable disapprobation by the more learned authorities." Jem and I were accustomed to our father's last will and testament diction, and we were at all times free to interrupt Atticus for a translation when it was beyond our understanding. Another thing my students were struck by, which surprised me, but I guess I my own experience might have something to do with that, was they were bothered by the fact that Jem and Scout call Atticus by his first name rather than his title, which is father or dad. And I can't exactly say what bothered them about it, but it kind of rubs people the wrong way. And I myself grew up, I'm the youngest of three, and I myself grew up calling my parents by their first names too, because it started as a family joke. My older brother and sister started calling my parents by their names. And so I followed suit, of course. So I didn't find it odd at all, but I'm always struck by people's reaction to that. It really gets under people's skin. They have a real response to it, as if it's disrespectful or somehow signals something wrong with the parent-child relationship if children call their parents by their names rather than by their titles.
That's so interesting. I'm trying to think if Aunt Alexandra got after the kids because they called him Atticus.
I believe she might have. She might have.
She got after them about so many things.
Yeah.
She was a force. And the irony was that she was so convinced that Atticus was doing a terrible job in raising children.
Right. When I personally thought he was doing a fantastic job. But
yeah. And wasn't she the mother of Cousin Francis who got Scout into trouble by insulting Atticus and
right.
Scout picked a fight with him?
Right. Yeah. And then Scout took a whipping, a hiding,
yes,
as they used to say, from Uncle Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And then she got very upset with Uncle Jack until she finally got him to sit down and listen to her. And she informed him that he'd failed to listen to her side of the story.
Right.
And then Atticus actually steps in and says, you know, she's right. You always have to listen to both sides of the story, being his lawyerly self.
I thought Uncle Jack was so funny when he said, "Remind me never to have children."
Right.
You know, they called him Atticus, but I noticed that Harper Lee dedicated her book to Mr. Lee and Alice, but to call her own father Mr. Lee.
Yeah.
So it was just, it's just like Harper Lee leaves a little train of interesting things that for us to wonder about.
Yeah.
I love it that she doesn't explain everything.
Yeah.
She's willing to give the reader a chance at working out our own explanations.
Yeah.
And I love it. Well, it's sort of like the language that she used. Well, Scupper knows. She didn't tell us what they were.
Right.
She'll
kind of hint at it. Sometimes quite vaguely. And
yeah.
Then I'm driven to the dictionary, I'm afraid. Yes.
You can look it up.
That's right. I wasn't quite sure what shinny was until I'd heard it a couple of times and realized it was probably moonshine or liquor or something.
Right.
I love the way that she talks about Aunt Alexandra's language.
I'll read that.
As well, she says, Aunt Alexandra was one of the last of her kind. She had riverboat boarding school manners. Let any moral come along, and she would uphold it. She was born in the objective case. She was an incurable gossip. When Aunt Alexandra went to school, self-doubt could not be found in any textbook, so she knew not its meaning. She was never bored, and given the slightest chance, she would exercise her royal prerogative. She would arrange, advise, caution, and warn.
That gives you a pretty good picture of Aunt Alexandra.
It does. It does.
Another part that wasn't in the movie that I was sorry they didn't have in it was when Jim lost his temper with Mrs. DuBose next door.
Right, and destroys all the camellias.
Yes, and then Atticus let him go all the way through his punishment of reading to her without explaining why it was so important, because I so admired Atticus. You know, to me, they're real people. I know
yeah.
they're creations of Harper.
I know. They don't feel like it by the end of the book.
They don't feel like it. I always have to remind myself in really good novels, these are constructs of the author, not real people. But she did such a beautiful job with the way Atticus handled that.
Yeah. And in fact, it seemed to me that Jem and Scout didn't really understand until the very end, and Atticus still had to explain to them what was actually going on, you know, that she was dying and in a great deal of pain and taking morphine to ease the pain, and that she wanted to die free of that addiction, and that his reading to her every day was a way to take her mind off herself and sort of get her through the bad spots of breaking the addiction.
Just as Jem and Scout really didn't understand about Boo Radley, that they bought the myth that he was some kind of an ogre,
right?
And they were titillated by that. And it wasn't until the very end, when Scout once again recalled her father's instructions to walk around in somebody else's skin,
right.
I'm so glad there's no sequel to this book.
Yeah.
I am so glad that she didn't feel it necessary to tell us what happened to Scout.
Yeah, although it's sad, too. I was saying to my students the other night that I found it heartbreaking. You know, it's heartbreaking at the end when she walks Mr. Arthur home and she goes up on the porch. He goes in. He shuts the door. No words have passed between them. And then she says, and I never saw him again. I don't know. I found it very moving. And, you get a feel for him at the end and how much he cares for these children in his very quiet, behind-the-scenes way and how much joy they have probably brought him, you know.
When Jem went up and touched the door.
Right.
On a dare. He said later, Scout, somebody was laughing.
Right. Yeah, and Scout says something like that, too, when they push her in the tire and she spins around and bumps into the stairs. And, yeah, they're sort of aware of this. And you have this sense when the gifts are in the tree and they keep, you know, stumbling on one after another that they... Jem, in particular, has a pretty good idea where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm. I was very interested in Scout, the tomboy, and was thinking through other literature. And I was, at the same time, I was reading Carolyn Hybron's book, Hamlet's Mother and Other Women,
mm.
and which is it's a a wonderful book. I mean, analyzing the some of the famous women in literature. She does a beautiful job. But she has a very interesting essay on Little Women.
Huh.
And Joe's identity as the boy of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the family constellation is different. The father is away, the mother is there, and the four daughters. So you can't really compare it to Scout, a situation in which the mother's gone, the father's there, and she has a brother.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there's some aspects of that situation. It was interesting to me to see how Louisa May Alcott handled it, and how Harper Lee handled it, writing much later.
Yeah.
And, of course, Alcott married her off not to her sweetheart next door, but to an older man, and then had her raising boys. So there's some kind of theme going on here that I'm not sure enough of you know, literary analysis to draw any conclusions from it. But I was trying to think of other tomboy characters.
Anne of Green Gables.
Oh, there you go. An orphan.
An right. orphan, one of our favorite young adult themes.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And being raised by a family, a couple unrelated to her, right?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
But it's such an interesting subject, I think, for a novelist. And it's not like so many of the novels written now in which the young person is badly treated. Because certainly Joe and Scout were cherished and loved, and so was Anne,
mm-hmm.
Eventually, mm-hmm. Anne of Green Gables. But I don't know if there's any kind of a pattern here or if I'm just reaching for some kind of revelation.
Well, what strikes me as you're talking about this is that I wonder if current authors of young adult literature have, if the issues have changed in the sense that we're talking about violation of gender roles, you know, expected gender roles. Whereas now we have books like Ellen Whitlinger's Hard Love, and she has a new book out too called Love and Lies, and Marisol, who's one of the major characters in that book, is gay. And so she, too, is embodying unexpected gender roles and running into those kinds of things. And actually, there are quite a number of more recent novels written. And, of course, they all end up on the banned books list. Another one is Annie on My Mind. And then there's a newer one. Let's see. Annie on My Mind is written by Nancy Garden, I believe. And there's another book, more recent, I think it came out in the early 90s, by Carla Trujillo called What Night Brings. And so I think there's a shift, perhaps, in the kinds of issues young people are facing around gender and gender identity. I don't know, but I think it's an interesting... I think it's an interesting idea.
There's an awareness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And while there is perhaps more freedom to be a tomboy, there are other rules that are still not supposed to be broken.
And Harper Lee never married. She went to live in New York near her sister. I don't think they lived together, but her sister, the attorney. So they were continued to be very independent women, which may say something or may not.
Yeah.
I wish we had another hour to talk about this. We're really just getting into it. It's been such a pleasure, Mira. It's been quite a revelation to hear about the way your students view this material and how you go about teaching them. It sounds quite wonderful.
Well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. My guest has been Mira Katz, Associate Professor of English at Sonoma State. Mira teaches courses geared specifically to those who hope to become English teachers. And thank you so much for sharing your insights. Hope you'll come again and wish you well in your work.
Thank you.
Thanks to Suzanne Lang, who produces the show. And thanks to KRCB and all the others who are bringing the big read to all of us in Sonoma County. To find out more about how you can become involved in the Big Read, go to the website bigreadsonoma.com or call Robin Metelitz, Outreach Coordinator here at KRCB at 707-584-2005. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. Thanks for listening. We'll meet again November 12th. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like an eagle in the air. Sometimes I feel like an eagle in the air. Sometimes I feel like an eagle in the air. Feel like an eagle in the air. Feel like an eagle in the air.
I've asked Robin Metelitz to join me to talk about The Big Read. Robin is the outreach coordinator for KRCB and the project director for The Big Read. Thanks for taking the time, Robin.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate your coming in. Tell me a little bit of the overall perspective of The Big Read. People may not know about The Big Read, how it works and what we do.
Okay, well, The Big Read is a national project funded by the National Endowment for the Arts. And what it is to really bring reading to a more central role in public life. So they fund more than 300 communities around the country to pick a book from a list of books that they have. And they provide resources for those communities to then encourage everybody to read that particular book. And this here in Sonoma County has grown out of Sonoma County Reads, which is a long-running county-wide reading program.
And so the Big Read and Sonoma County Reads have now sort of merged?
The Big Read Sonoma County is the continuation of Sonoma County Reads.
And this has been going on for a while.
That's right. Well, this is our second year for the Big Read Sonoma County. But
okay.
as you probably know, Sonoma County Reads has been happening for, I think, just about a decade now.
Yes, and I'm sure our listeners remember
remember the Ray Bradbury dramatizations and the readings from that book. And it seems to get bigger every year, so that this year the scheduled events is just amazing. The website is a really good source.
www.bigreadsonoma.com. And that has a calendar of events and has other ways for you to get involved in the community around the Big Read Sonoma County. Mm-hmm. One of the things we did this year that's new is something called The Flight of the Mockingbird. We released more than 100 copies of the book into the wild. The big launch of that was at our kickoff at the book festival. And what folks are encouraged to do is read the book and then leave it somewhere where someone can find it. So keep an eye out, you know, in your gym or your doctor's office or your neighborhood coffee shop, because you might find a copy of To Kill a Mockingbird.
And if you find one, it's okay to pick it up.
Pick it up, take it home, read it, leave it for someone else to find. So if you go to bigreadsonoma.com, there's something called the Big Read blog where you can leave your comments. And there's also a raffle we're holding. So if you found the book, you can enter that raffle and win a prize.
So this is a case when it's okay to steal this book.
Exactly. And when we did our first launch, one of the things we asked folks is to give us an idea where they might be leaving the book. So if you want to find a copy, one of the things I've already put up on that Big Read blog is just a few places people mentioned, some places you might want to look yourself.
The county libraries are really involved in this project.
That's right. And that's one of the really great things. We really love the involvement of the libraries. They've been involved in a bunch of different levels. Everything from the fact that at every single branch of the county library, there's going to be a book discussion, some of them bilingual. And then at many branches, they're going to also hold screenings and discussions of the film To Kill a Mockingbird, which I think a lot of folks remember with Gregory Peck.
Oh, yes.
One of the great things we did this year, which we also did last year, was involve them in some of our little TV spots. Last year, we had them do readings, and this year, we invited a couple of library staff to give their impressions and thoughts and memories of the book.
And, Robin, you're coordinating this whole project.
That's right. I'm the project director. We've been working with the library and a couple other great groups like the Arts Council of Sonoma County. The book festival was really helpful, and Sonoma State University Library and Santa Rosa Junior College Library. So.
But what a lot of work you've done to get this project rolling.
Well, you know, KRCB is, as you know, is very committed to the idea of literacy and encouraging folks to read, and has made this project a priority. And that's why I spend a lot of time on it.
I was interested in happenings over in the town of Sonoma at Reader's Garden. That sounded like an interesting get-together at the General Vallejo House, and the dates for those meetings are on the website. So people in Sonoma, check it out.
One of the things I would really encourage folks to do is there's definitely opportunities if you go to the website for whatever town you live in or live near to participate there. But I would also encourage you to try going to some of the other towns in our community and participate in book discussions at other libraries. That's one of the things I really strive to do, is use this as an opportunity to involve the whole county.
And it's a great idea to see the other county libraries in the various towns.
That's right. I mean, if you don't live in Rohnert Park, for example, they have a beautiful new library. That's where we filmed all of our TV spots this year and last year.
Another event that's going to take place here on KRCB on the 22nd of October, a very special broadcast. You're going to do the book club on the air.
That's right. Live call-in show. So I encourage everybody to read the book before then so they can participate.
I think that's going to be a fantastic evening, because it comes as the whole project is winding down, so that the Mockingbird books have had time to fly around and be read any number of times. People will be familiar with the story and can call in on that evening. And that's Wednesday evening, the 22nd of October at 7 p.m., the book club on the air. Thank you, Robin, for taking the time from your busy day to come in and talk with us about the Big Read. And thanks for all the work you've done to plan these events and make them happen.
Thanks, Rosemary. Thanks for everything you do for A Novel Idea.